Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Mike Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Mary Carr, the author of The Liar's Cub, a memoir recently published by Viking. She is the author as well of two books of poetry, The Devil's Tour, published by New Directions, and Abacus. This book seems like such an eruption, and I remember that, well, an eruption of voice, you know, and declared emotional terror. I've read that you've wrote it three times as a novel before it became a memoir. What was the shift? And do you find traces of the novel still in it? And does that mean a difference in the quality of truth-telling? Complicated question.
No, it's a great question. It was only, I tried to write it once as a novel, but that's not important. I mean, what I found that I think, I don't know much about novels, which would make me ill-equipped to write one. I'm surprised now that people think because I've written a book of prose that I would be any better, you know, prepared to write a novel, which seems to me like an art form. That you have to study the way you study a sonnet or something. And I'm a real moron, it turns out, about novels. I have read an awful lot of memoirs and did before. What I found when I tried to write a novel, other than that I didn't know anything about novel structure, you talk to somebody like Don DeLillo, he says, you know, I'm working on a 1,500-page novel and I know the shape of it. And you just want to fall over. How is that possible? If you're a lyric poet or you aspire to being a lyric poet, it seems to have all that stuff in your head. I can't imagine it. But for me, I lied more. The character who was me in the novel behaved nobly, always with great intelligence, with forbearance. She was beautiful. She was wise. I mean, she was everything I wasn't and hadn't been. So I think real novelists or real fiction writers really do tell a greater truth in fiction. And for me, I just didn't have that. I didn't have that.
What started you writing The Liar's Cub?
Well, I mean, there's a glib answer, and I'll give that one first. Money. My marriage had ended, and I didn't have a car. And I didn't have any furniture in my house. And I had run into the woman who became my agent. I won this award, the Whiting Writers Award in New York, and I met her there. She was an agent of Tobias Wolff, who was an old friend of mine from my early 20s, and I hadn't seen him in a long time. And we all went out to dinner, and I was sort of questioning why there were so many. I'd always loved memoir and been interested in it more than 20th century memoir. Had always interested me, and I couldn't figure out why there were so many really fine men's memoirs, and why it seemed to me then, this is less true now, it was like 92 or something, when women wanted to write autobiographically, they seemed to turn to fiction. You know, why would Harper Lee write To Kill a Mockingbird when, you know, Hemingway would write Movable Feast? Why would Mona Simpson write Anywhere But Here when Frank Conroy would write Stop Time? Why, why would Sylvia Plath write The Bell Jar when Tobias Wolff would write This Boy's Life? I just couldn't figure it out. And there were exceptions, the Mary McCarthy's Catholic Girlhood and the first Maya Angelou book, I Know Where the Caged Bird Sings, seemed to me very artful, moving, powerful works of art. But I couldn't figure it out, and I was sort of talking about that, and partly I was at Radcliffe at the time at the Bunting Institute, and I was looking for these. I knew there must be these great women's memoirs from this century, and where were they? Wasn't private domestic life our rubric? I mean, didn't we get to have that while guys were out writing novels, and you know, being James Joyce and stuff? And so I kept waiting for these brilliant feminist scholars to haul out this treasure trove of memoirs, not novelized, not autobiographical fiction. And they kept not doing it. And my agent, Amanda Urban at ICM, said, and I was also talking later, just more casually, about telling stories. I dined out on my family for many years. I think if you have it all, if you have a mother who marries seven times, you know, you eat some meals, you know, telling her stories. And she sort of suggested that I might write a book proposal. It was the kind of thing you hear at a dinner party and then ignore because it just seemed polite. And then I saw her about 7 or 8 months later in a bar and had no idea she would even remember who I was. And she said, well, where's my book proposal? And I just said, I'm a poet, you know, I don't know how to write one. And she said, oh, you know, it's very simple. And she sort of explained it to me. So, I mean, that's the glib answer or the business answer. But I tried to write this story as a novel. I think if, you know, in the poems you can see that I dealt a lot with my family, my grief over my distance from them and their difficulties. And I was always interested in the memoir form as a form. So, I mean, I taught classes in it at Tufts and at Syracuse University where I now teach. So it was standing in line, I think, for me to write it. It wanted to be written. I wanted to write it. And then I just had this very compelling financial need. And
it's very interesting to me because I sense in you from talking to you here and before and in some of the essays I've read, there's a strong combative nature.
Mm-hmm.
And you've said about writing poems about your children, well, sometimes I want to kill my children.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to write noble poems.
Mm.
When I hear this kind of business, when people tell me that a poet can't support him or herself, there's something in me that wants to, you know, rise up on my hackles and say, I'm going to prove that a poet can.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, some of the novels in verse that we've seen recently are the results of that. Did you feel betrayed by being told that if you continued to work this material in your own form as poetry material, that, yeah, you were going to be hungry?
Oh, I was never hungry. No, I'm not of that school. I was enormously privileged. I mean, I was a college professor. It's not like I was, you know, I have rooted in garbage cans in Southern California. When I first left home, I lived in a car, you know, so I know from hungry. I wasn't hungry. No, I was able to support myself and my child. I owned my own home. I had a job. I had health insurance. So please don't believe me. But I couldn't, I don't like the novels in verse, frankly. I think the epic, I'm about to teach a course on the epic, about which I'm increasingly aware of my ignorance. But I think they're a mistake. I think the epic form, when there was no other form to, you know, record history and describe domestic life, and so I just think that poetry as a form, I'm just much more interested in. It's personal taste, really. Lyric poetry. I like a little low-tech, you know, 14-line thing that is the whole artistic experience that you can have in your mind all at once. It seems to me, you know, I've just always liked, you know, lyric poetry.
You know, because as I was reading The Liar's Club by my guest Mary Carr, published by Viking, I think even if they hadn't told me, I'd know that a poet had written it. I
mean, oh, God love you.
Well, I guess it's the things that I was saying before, the natural descriptions, what seemed to me to be building the whole thing around earth, air, fire, and water, the willingness to suspend action while an image is held to replace it. It does seem to me that the Texas, the initial Texas section is, you know, kind of an unbroken story of an image. I mean, it's a beautifully done thing. So I guess I always end up saying, doesn't it seem unfair that someone who has the skills as a poet should have to turn to the form of prose in order to make a consistent address or to solve a financial problem? I always feel that the world is unfair.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I just felt really lucky not to be, you know, stamping out jar lids on some factory floor. You know, I mean, as a way, it just seems teaching is much maligned as a way to make a living. And, I mean, I think it's sad. I remember the poet Alan Grossman has a line I've stolen where he's talking about his poems, and he said, I'd drop them from a helicopter if they would be more read. And I certainly think, or I think of Stevens, but then again, it's sort of counter to that. There's a great line in one of Wallace Stevens's letters. People would like poetry. No. People like poetry the way a child likes snow. And they would if poets wrote it, you know. So I think the estrangement between the poet and her audience is a very, you know, pernicious phenomenon. And it's something we as poets are partly responsible for. I mean, obviously, there's television. There are all the old saws that are been complained about. Bob Hass and I actually just did a conversation for some magazine, I can't remember, and he was telling me something I didn't know about the, you know, we imagine a golden age of poetry during the, say, in England during, you know, the Romantics, you know, Wordsworth, Keats, Byron, Shelley, you know, this long unbroken line. And if you know a lot of British people, they can quote all these guys, and then you think of the lyrical ballads as a popular form, and that you think there was this age when, you know, everyone in England was reading Wordsworth by the bushel, and and they were making zillions of, you know, they were, and he said, you know, 80% of the people in England, I can't remember the percentage, were illiterate, you know, and the people who were considered literate, the test for literacy was whether you could sign your name, you know. So
so no one knew.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, if you look at editions, you know, they would print, as they do now, 800. I mean, I think if you're a poet, and this is, I think, an advantage for me, particularly in something as evil and corrupting as a book tour, for a writer. I mean, it's not a good thing to talk about something you've already written. I think it's not healthy. And for any artist to be preoccupied with. But I think if you're a poet, you do school yourself to take the long view. You know, you really, or I have done, to really try to think of, you know, Sappho, you know. You know, so you try to think of what your audience is going to be for perpetuity. And you know, you write how many poems in your life? How many great poems did Yeats write? You know, how many great, you know, Matthew Arnold wrote one, Dover Beach, you know.
Yeats wrote more than most, I think.
He wrote more than anybody, I think, in this century, don't you?
I do. Now, I'm curious. In The Devil's Tour, there are a lot of memento mori poems about death, and that tragic vision, or what I thought was, you know, an austerity, appears in The Liar's Club. The new tone seems to be wild and sometimes misanthropic, vulgar comedy. Did you know you'd be able to do that?
I knew I did it in my life. I mean, I've always done. I was the, you know, kicked out of high school about 97 times for, you know, wild and misanthropic behavior. So I, in some ways, I was, me and vulgar comedy went way back. I was stealing my, I was trying to steal my father's voice. It was an homage to his, He had this many of the people in his family are this way. He was an amazing storyteller. He was that great ability Chekhov has to pick, the one detail about a person or the one gesture that tells you everything about their character. You know, everything about the character is revealed from one thing, one action or one feature. And so it was the combination of that very astute intelligence to human character, pacing, use of metaphor, and idiom, and just the vernacular, the surface of the language, which was so heavily stressed, monosyllabic, pounded, dumb, boneheaded. It was fun to be in that, you know.
So it begins, in a sense, with the tapes you made of your father speaking.
Absolutely.
Because I did notice as you go into the Liars Club and you find words that you don't find in the poems. And, you know, Kenner used to say to us, watch what field the word comes from.
Field, what did he mean?
He meant what Donald Davies meant when he meant field of diction.
Oh,
that you would
I
find
see.
A single word in a line that would...
Mm-hmm. From the Sanskrit or something. You mean etymological roots?
Not just etymological roots, but, you know, suddenly in a line of William Carlos Williams, a set of random words elevated about the stars, there's the word thumbtack.
Mm-hmm.
And it says it tells you when William Carlos Williams is living and how to regard the earlier elevated words.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing. You come into the Liars Club. There's a whole set of words that you wouldn't find in any of these poems, words like noggin, all these kind of bumptious, almost as if you've given yourself the right, as
permission.
You haven't had in your poetry, to use the whole thing you grew up with.
Hmm. So smart. I never thought of it that way. I mean, it seems absolutely – I felt that. I had that feeling about it, like that, yeah, I suddenly had permission – the poet Craig Raine was, in talking about Robert Lowell, said something that most of American poetry since Life Studies, certainly, but since 1950, I think was the date he gave, has been about what you can get in, getting things in, either in terms of subject or language. And for me, I guess that's right.
Well, there's also something interesting, too. And it's there in both places. I'm not going to hit it because I haven't been thinking of it long enough, but it's sort of like a state on the verge of hysteria.
Hmm.
In the poems, it seems like the calm before the storm.
Hmm.
In the novel, it's a kind of different thing. Things have already gotten so bad that the kind of hysteria is more likely, as with one of your parents' arguments where they find themselves laughing hysterically and going out for fried shrimp. it's that kind of, I'm about to topple back into the human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, it felt that way to write it. I mean, you know, it did feel very raw.
But are you drawn
to
hysteria?
Well, I'm Southern. I mean, somebody said to me, I have a guy, I play softball at the university where I teach, and one of the guys was a PhD student who was studying Southern Gothic, he said. And I said, tell me something. What is the difference between, I said, what do you mean by Southern Gothic? He said, oh, you know, people like doing really hysterical, dramatic things and, you know, really raw, blah, blah. He named five or six, you know, incest, blah, 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 stuff like, you know, wild, violent, blah. I said, how is Southern Gothic different than just Southern, you know? We're talking about the 20th century. I mean, who is Southern, who isn't Southern Gothic? I mean, help find, and he thought for a minute. He was sort of puzzled by it. So I think that's partly my character. I mean, it's my nature to be combative. And to be outspoken. It's part of the class I came from and part of the place I came from. And I think so. I mean, you know, as you were talking about the essay before, I value feeling, because I think for a lot of my life I avoided it. You know, it was a relief when I started feeling things or something.
Because the voice in The Devil's Tour is the voice of a poet. I know that she loves the wasteland. You know.
Oh yeah.
The voice here in The Liars' Club is the voice of someone who wishes that Mark Twain had written a book by a girl. You know what I mean? That it's not fair that Huckleberry Finn is a boy's book.
We were cheated. It's funny you mention Mark Twain. That was James Laughlin, who's my publisher. That was his, what he thought of the memoir. He said, "I feel like it's like Mark Twain, a girl Mark Twain from Texas." Well, I should be so lucky. You
know? Well, it's very interesting because I once read an essay by this Jesuit named Walter Ong, and he was asking, why is it so hard to ask people, students, to write? And he said, well, you go in there, he says, it's teacher's fault. You say, what did you do during your summer vacation? And before long, what really, really happens is that the kid goes, who's asking?
Yeah.
You can't imagine talking to teacher.
Right.
You can't imagine talking to grandma.
Right.
You can't imagine talking to mom and dad, and they were probably there.
Right.
Not about your real feelings.
Right.
So before long, you start to think, if you're the crafty kid who does well on these things,
mm-hmm.
teacher likes Catcher in the Rye. Teacher likes Huckleberry Finn.
Hmm.
I'm going to write the naughty, puckish essay of someone who, no matter what, had a hilarious bad time. And he said, I notice after years of teaching that I have to go back and say, you don't have to be Huckleberry Finn to please me.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
I was so amazed by that, especially by the implicit idea then that it was the teacher's obligation to come up with an assignment that someone could write.
Mm. Right.
I mean, trying to figure out what that assignment might be is a world in itself.
I know. I know my kid's in poetry camp now. This is a kid who's never not played with a bat and ball.
Poetry camp?
He's doing like a 1 week at his dad's house in New Haven, poetry camp. And this is a kid who's like a big golden retriever. And I said to him, well, what are you writing about? And he said, well, I wanted to write a poem about going on vacation with my dad. And I worked on that for a day. And then I realized I was just trying to be nice, he said, whatever that means, he said. I said, so what are you writing about now? He said, building a go-kart. I don't know. I mean, but it seemed to me an improvement. I mean, he's really interested in building a go-kart. I'm not sure how interested he is in writing about going on vacation. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I know exactly what you're saying because I think in a certain way, I've been saying this for a little while, but when I got to junior high, the first thing they asked us to do was to write about the most unforgettable person we ever met. And I would go, who? How? You know, I don't know.
Right.
And you'd end up writing this thing about, you know, dad,
right.
Because you were supposed to.
Yeah, exactly.
I think this, we don't like not knowing how to answer a question.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our generation, we're roughly the same age, you and I, are writing these memoirs out of, you know, that whole background of being asked questions 25 years ago that we couldn't answer.
Mm.
And now, you know, freed of authority, you know, the most unforgettable person I've ever met in your book is your mother.
My mother. Well, she is the most unforgettable person you'll meet. I mean, that's a genuine. I mean, that you're probably right on that. I think she's pretty amazing.
Did she ever want to write?
No. My mother is not. My father is very verbal. I mean, my mother read enormously, but she is not. She is the master of the one-liner. But to tell a whole story. Never happen. Or to isolate an element of character. She doesn't have that. She's very visual. You know, she sees things. She was a painter, and so she sees things in a way my that wouldn't be conducive to writing. Although when she does write, she's very smart, she's very articulate, and she's really great at answering machine messages. If you call her phone now, it says, last week it was, I don't know who I am. I don't know where I am or what I'm doing. But if you leave a message, I'll get back to you. But it was the tone of genuine puzzlement, you know. And then this week it was, hi, this is Tinkerbell. It was a 74-year-old woman, you know, thinking up a new answering machine message every week.
You go upstairs at the end of this book to a beautifully rendered attic full of the threat of snakes, watermelons, if I remember correctly. Mm. And there's a chest, in a sense, as there should be. Mm. It reminds me of Robert Frost's poem Directive,
all right,
where he suddenly comes up seeing a child's playset, weep for the little things that made them glad.
Oh, so sad. I know.
Yeah. But there is a chest there, you know, and inside the treasure chest is the past. You know, you find what you didn't know you'd find, your mother's 7 wedding rings, and it seems right that they be in a treasure chest because rings and caskets, you know, it all makes a kind of Alibaba pirate chest sense.
You don't believe I found that chest. You do not believe it. I can see it on your face.
Well, it's so astonishing.
I'm sorry. I swear to God. I don't know what to tell you. It was this big footlocker thing. And it was in fact, it was the only thing up there that wasn't cardboard, you know, that wasn't a thing of Christmas ornaments or something. I mean, I can see the disbelief on your face. I wish it had been less capital P poetic. And it did have my grandmother's leg in the bottom of it. And it scared me.
Prosthetic leg.
Yes, exactly. Prosthetic as opposed to stuffed. You know, yeah, that would have been real Southern Gothic, wouldn't it? No, I know. I see your disbelief. I'm sorry.
No,
I wish I could.
It's sort of admiration, I think. Jealousy. You're so lucky. If only others of us could find our past all drawn into such a convenient locus, you know, to find it all in one place.
Well, if you had a mother who had a serious lie in her past, it would come in one place. I mean, I think for Jeffrey Wolfe, hearing that his father never went to Yale was one place. You know, I think, the lies our parents tell us, they're usually the really big ones, you know, there might not be so many. You know, I think they do. I think our parents do become human scale, usually based on like a few simple facts.
I've been speaking to Mary Carr on the publication of The Liar's Cub, a memoir published by Viking. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.
Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse, Pop Dog.